So what do you do when life happens? After tonight, you'll know the answer. You get catalytic. My name is Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer. I am the host for your next hour, and we're very happy you chose to be with us for this recording. Whether you're hitting us live or via the archive, your heart's going to appreciate your having joined us tonight. We're going to be devoting an hour to the heart. We're going to be devoting an hour to living from the heart to live for the heart. And our special guest tonight is Dr. Michael Irving from Toronto, Canada. Dr. Irving has done many things during his life. He is a psychotherapist. He has worked in business. He's worked in education. He's also a sculptor. And we're going to talk about how his experiences in the adventures in the cardiovascular world have changed the way he lives his life and the way he helps other people who find him. But before we bring him on, I just want to tell a very, very brief story. So far, you may have noticed, if you've been regular listeners of the show, and we're happy if you have been, thank you so much, and please tell your friends about us. If you're regular listeners, you may have noticed that every guest I've had has been a personal friend. Dr. Irving is no exception. There's a reason for that. The people I have on the show are people who I know have beautiful hearts. I know them because they are my friends. The way Dr. Irving and I became friends, we were both taking a class in marketing, I believe in 2012, and we had to all go around on the telephone and introduce ourselves, say where we were from, and say what we wanted to get from the class. So at that point, I'd been through quite a few experiences, and I said what I wanted to get from the class, which was getting my work out there after having paid for my mother's dementia care for a number of years. And Dr. Irving, bless his heart, spoke up and said, "I want to work with you. Contact me, and I want to help you do what you need to do." That's somebody who came from heart from the get-go. I've gotten to know him and his beautiful wife, Cheryl. They're my friends. He's my colleague, and he's with us tonight. Dr. Irving, how are you?
I'm great, Cheryl. Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a couple of times around we've done radio shows, and it's always a pleasure.
Thank you. I always enjoy having you as my guest. I always learn things from you, and we do similar work in extremely different ways, so I always enjoy hearing what you're up to. And we haven't talked in a long time. We used to talk every week. And in the last couple of years, we haven't had a whole lot of contact. And you've been up to some pretty interesting stuff. We're going to start, with your permission. Would you please tell our listeners what happened to you that changed your health so dramatically from a man who had 3 years of really lousy health, including a bypass surgery, to somebody who runs frequent marathons? How did you do this?
I started a cardiac rehab program, and I had a VO2 of 26, which put me at 56 years old, at sort of that physiological heart health of a 65-year-old. And over the next couple of years, I radically changed the level of my heart health. When I was 64, the same test gave me a VO2 of 46, and then they stopped the test, which put me in the cardiac health of a 30-year-old. So to celebrate 65, I ran 5 marathons in 12 weeks, which kind of was a little bit different from the very, very overweight couch potato of 9 years earlier, and to having an extraordinary quality both of health, physical health, as well as emotional outlook health. And what I did on my 64th birthday is I did a marathon through the city of Toronto, and I ran by places that I thought had helped me to reverse my heart disease. And I started making the list, and it got longer and longer and longer, and it ended up by the time the morning of my Gratitude Day marathon, which is what I called it, I sat in front of my computer and went down the various websites and email lists of about 40 people who I felt had made a significant contribution to my reversing my heart disease. And one of them on my list that morning when I was doing a loving kindness meditation and gratitude was you, Cheryl. You were part of what I felt was reversing my heart disease. And I ran that day by 60 different stores, clinics, doctor's office, psychotherapist's office, health food stores, places that I felt helped to reverse my heart disease. And really what so many of those places weren't, in a sense, the whole issue of fuel and biology, which the heart is often seen as. I was reading a journal article a couple of weeks ago, and the journal article said the sole function of the heart is to pump blood. And I think back to literature and the story through history, and it's ridiculous. When you think of the word heart, you think of love, you think of kindness, you think of gratitude, you think of aesthetics and art, and to say the heart is just a pump and it's plumbing is kind of rude to the whole history of what we refer to as heart. That if you think about it, you would never put your hand on your head and pat your head and say, I'm Cheryl. You would put your hand on your chest and you would pat your heart and you'd say, I'm Cheryl. And I think that the heart being the seed of the self and the heart being the representing the soul and the place of the soul has a truth. And my reversing heart disease did incorporate eating better food choices and supplements and medicines, but I felt that on my Gratitude Day marathon, I felt that more it was why I was doing what I was doing and how I was doing it. That why I was doing it was because when I was gray as concrete, my son was at the foot of my bed wondering whether he was going to see his father another day. My friends who had seen me were calling other friends and saying, yeah, you got to drop by to see Irving this week because I don't think he's going to last any much longer. And it was the love that was shown to me and the sense that that those people made a difference to me and that I also made a difference to them. I felt like it was actually healing my heart and not just only healing my physical heart, but healing my emotional heart, my spiritual heart, and my aesthetic heart. And so I began a journey of really looking at heart health from a very, very different perspective. And I think that's why I had a remarkable change in my heart health from being 65 at a 56-year-old to being 30 years old at a 65-year-old. And I just finished the marathon 2 days ago, so I'm still at it.
So what you're saying is you're not doing much of anything these days. You're just kind of hanging out watching TV, right? in awe. You're able to... Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's really fascinating because I feel really young, and my mind is really young. And I started a whole new career, which is learning internet technology and digital technology and how to make audio sessions. And I had a very fulfilling life where I learned many different things. And now, as an elder, I'm turning my knowledge and my learned gifts, I'm turning them into digital files, and I'm giving lots of that information away and sharing it in various ways through my website, which is heartwellness.irvingstudios.com. And so, in some ways, my website is about being an art and being an artist, which is the sculpture and the art that's there, but also the way in which digital technology itself is a form of art and it's a form of communication. And I'm learning to communicate with digital downloads the wisdom that I've learned about the heart.
That's brilliant. And this might be a good time to mention to the audience that you have gifts for all of us on your website.
Yes, I do. When you go to the website, heartwellness.irvingstudios.com, there will be an icon with me and my marathon clothes surrounded by a heart made of hands that have helped me out. And below that it says a gift to the BBS radio audience. So if you click on that, I will pass on to you an e-book that you'll get in eight different chapters over a few days. And then at the end of receiving that e-book, there's another special gift that's coming along. So there's a few surprises there, as well as some very interesting visualizations, guided imageries, and progressive relaxations.
Wonderful. And I just going to repeat the name of your website, just in case people didn't get it. It's I have it written down here. Just give me a second here. Heartwellness.irvingstudios. That's plural. Irvingstudios.com. Heartwellness.irvingstudios.com, correct?
Yes, and everyone who goes there can click on the icon that I just made this afternoon for our radio audience, and it'll say, this is your gift as a radio audience participant.
Yeah, I was impressed. I was on your website after you'd done this work, and I'm thinking, wow, he really wants to do this. He really wants to help us all learn. So thank you for going to this much trouble for all of us, and I'm going to be going there after the show and get my gifts because I'm allowed, right? I'm your host.
It would be my pleasure to have you get that material.
Stand in line behind me, again. I'm getting there first, just so you know you've been warned.
Yeah. Well, that's what's so amazing. You know, when I carve sculptures, they you know, sometimes one piece will take an entire month. Or yeah, there's one sculpture that I worked on, a couple of million-dollar work of art that took me, a good decade to make the one piece of art. And then you have to sell it, and somebody, carries it away in a truck, and it's gone. But what's really, really cool about digital art and digital creation is that it can be downloaded over and over and over again. And I find that really, really an exciting form of communication, that you can spend a lot of time putting something together really well, and then you can continue to share it on and on and on. And I think that's so cool about where we are in history and in technology.
And part of the deal about getting older doesn't mean you don't stop learning. We're always learning. So bless you for learning this new stuff that was never something you learned before, but it's here for you now. Before we get into our conversation about the 12 wisdoms and the other things we're going to cover, I would love if you would share your story about the white light message you received from your guide.
When I first had, I went through 3 years of cardiac crisis. I had a heart attack, I had a stroke, I had stents, I had carotid artery surgery. It seemed like every 3 or 4 months I was in an ambulance. It was a lot of work. I was quite overweight and really, really, really stressed out. After my stroke, the surgeon, Dr. Campbell, who did my carotid artery surgery, he said, a lot of this stenosis is new stuff. And I said, it's really been the most stressful time of my business career has been the last couple of years. And he said, or last couple of months. And he said, I can't stress to you how much you've got to get your stress under control. So I started getting my stress under control, and I started doing lots of mindfulness meditation and other forms of meditation, loving kindness, which I really, really like. And I was in great physical health. I raced a 42-kilometer race in the hot July weather. And the day after, I ended up in intensive care again. And I was wondering, oh, my gosh, what am I doing? And I started the process to go through bypass surgery. And my son, we're Cherokee and Choctaw, and he's grown up with some traditional ceremonies and naming and sweats and various things. And he comes with his medicine bundle and some of his sacred objects and my sacred objects and an eagle feather that I was given for my work with children. And he said, we know that you want to do a Sundance, a vision quest. And we're concerned that if you do it on the prairies, that if something like this happens, you're not going to make it to the hospital. So there's nothing that's going to happen in the cardiac theater that's going to be any less than what you would go through in the arduousness of the Sundance in order to have a vision. So we did ceremony that night, and we did the ceremony in the morning, and when I went into the cardiac theater, I was just in awe at the technology there, because they stop your heart from beating. They, you, in a sense, they chill your body and you're kind of dead in a sort of way. And then after they sew you back up and put you back together, they bring you back to life. But they also have to be ready for kidney failure or stroke or any number of things that can happen. So the technology in the theater is just amazing. And I just felt like the people there were really passionate about what they were doing, like they were working, they were living from their heart and their work. And so I had my medicine bundle in the cardiac theater on top of my luggage, and the nurse says to me, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, we're Cherokee and Choctaw, that's my medicine bundle." And she said, "That doesn't belong there." And she picks up the medicine bundle, and she puts it under the bed, the table that the heart surgery is going to go on. And it was like everything was really right and really appropriate. It's the way that it should happen. And I felt really touched by her compassion and her thoughtfulness. And then I was put under with the anesthesia, and I believe that it was from the ceremony that I did with Zach and some of the sacred medicines that we used, that when I went under the surgery and my chest was cut open, there was a part of my consciousness that was alert and aware to what was going on. And I wasn't frightened by it. I was more in awe of it. And when the surgeon, when the surgeon came in the room, he came in with this beautiful artistic hat, which is what I needed as an artist. I felt like he was really working from his art, from his heart, both in his passion for the technology and his skill, and his passion to be to dress like an artist. And so when his hand touched my heart, it was like this gray that had once been black. It was like all time was one time. And so I was aware that at one time it was where my heart was black, but it was now gray. And this gray lifted and left. And it was like the blackness had been the way in which the severe abuse of my childhood had made a blackness in my heart. And I was aware that my heart disease was in part because of the broken heart of how I was abused so much as a child. So the next day, I see the surgeon, and I first saw my son, and I told him about this experience that I had while I was under in this gray leading. And then I saw the surgeon, and I asked him, you know, how my heart was, my arteries, because you can't see on the inside of them unless you do surgery. And he said, whatever you're doing, your arteries are clear as an athlete's. And what happened was there was some scar tissue from an earlier surgery that was built up, and it blocked off the artery, and that's why we needed to do the surgery. And I felt a kind of a gratitude almost about having to do the open heart surgery, because it left the gray left, because I was touched, my heart was touched by the entire event and the unfolding of the process, and also because the way in which I got to know that what I was doing in terms of how I was eating and how I was changing my stress and everything else was, had eroded, had dissolved the heart disease. And there was a gratefulness for that, for that the surgery was one way to show that. And then I told the doctor about this experience of this gray leaving, which was a very, very profound experience for me. And so, you know, when he told me that I was in the shape of an athlete, he left, and I went off for a 20-minute walk 18 hours after open heart surgery. And I come back, and the nurse is a little bit agitated. Her heart patient had disappeared. And so she checks my blood, and I'm low on oxygen. So she puts a mask on me. And when she put the mask on me and left, she told me, "Don't leave, lay down, don't go anywhere." And then what happened was she forgot to turn on the oxygen in all of the the frazzleness of everything. She forgets to turn on the oxygen. So here I've got I'm low on oxygen. I've got a mask in which I'm just rebreathing to carbon dioxide. I'm not even getting the oxygen of the air. And then I went into the white light. And later when I came out of it, and I did live through it. You know, the white light is that passage between life and death. And I did have later. I had a feeling of gratitude that she had left this oxygen off, because it let me go into the white light, and in the white light a guide met me. And I that was the most profound experience of my life in terms of the amount of that it's impacted me over the last 7 years. And in that white light, the guide said to me, the greatest gift your parents gave to you was the severity of their abuse and the extent of their abuse. I was tortured with rapes from infancy through adolescence. I was beaten unconscious. I was tortured by really crazy and sick people. And the guide said that what they gave to you was the breadth of your wisdom and the depth of your compassion. And that was a little difficult to accept, but, you know, I'm in the white light and I'm listening to this, and then a circle of elders come, which is apropos for my part of my cultural background. And there's one space in the circle of elders, and the circle of elders told me that it's time for me to join the circle of elders and to use my wisdom and my compassion. And the next summer and fall, when I would be out for my runs, and those times when I would just sort of ruminate and think back to all of the rotten things that people had done to me and the wrongs in the world, rather than look at them as wrong, I started reevaluating them and seeing them in a different perspective, seeing the ways in which I learned something from, in which I gained something from. And it's the way in which I can now give back to others because of the path that I traveled. And there began to be a different meaning to the post-traumatic stress. And rather than those things being something that had stolen something from me, that had robbed me, I began to be able to appreciate that there was something that I had been gifted because of those experiences. And it's a realm beyond the idea of forgiveness, which I had worked on in therapy for years. And it was really an acceptance of what had happened, an acceptance of life, an acceptance of the people who I had encountered in life, and that I could be something more, and I could be something different. And I now work with people, with individuals with post-traumatic stress and pain clients, and I work in a Wings Neuro Rehab Clinic. So people with brain injuries or people with pretty bad post-traumatic stress, and there's a way in which I see transformation every day that I appreciate being an observer to, and others appreciate being able to achieve. And that white light experience, that guide giving me a different view of the meaning of adversity. And I would never wish an adversity on somebody. I don't think it's right to harm other people. But I think that there's a difference that when you are harmed and you say, I'm going to get through this, there's a lesson, there's an opportunity, there's something that I'm going to make better out of this, and that you walk forward with positive thinking, that those three elements, I'll get through, there's a gift, and I'm just going to look at the positive in my life, that shifts the way in which one encounters and works through an adversity. And, you know, one of my adversities is heart disease. And by having heart disease, I've learned a lot about reversing heart disease. And by having my history of wounds and having a wounded heart, I really look at heart disease from a different perspective. I look at how we have lost heart, and that causes heart disease. We're not living from our heart, and that contributes to heart dis-ease. And heart dis-ease contributes to heart disease. Now, there are definitely issues about choosing the right kinds of foods, but it's also not only the food you choose, but the way that you choose to to encounter that food? Is it cooked with love? That's the heart. Is it aesthetic? Is it vibrant? Is it beautiful? That's heart. Is it shared with in community with other people? That's from the heart. When you sit down, do you have gratitude for the plants that grew it, for the people that cultivated it? Do you feel loving kindness towards sharing the meal? All of those things. What do we mean by heart? And I believe that that's what we should look at in terms of our food and our exercise and our spirituality and everything else that has an impact on heart disease.
This was a lot of information. You may have just changed at least one life by what you just said. First of all, by sharing your story about the white light message from your guide. When you can look at something in your life that was so traumatic and so painful and so, as you say, wrong, and turn it into a learning, turn it into a gift, that's something we need to be practicing more and more. I tell my clients the same thing. No matter what you're going through, there is a gift. You just have to find it. It's in there somewhere. So thank you for sharing that person.
Napoleon Hill wrote in 1950, in the early 50s, Napoleon Hill wrote, every adversity has an equal or greater benefit. Every adversity has an equal or even greater benefit. And Buddha, a few thousand years ago, said almost identical, that in your adversities is where you will find gifts. And there is a trauma aspect to having an adversity, but if we just work with only a trauma model, we lose the real depth of humanity, and I think we lose our heart. We come at it from anger and hurt and all of these dark negative things, and we believe that if we purge all of the negative, we'll be free. And I believe that you have to connect with heart and everything that we mean by heart in all aspects of your life to really be fulfilled. And that includes how we encounter our adversities as well as how we encounter what we eat or how we exercise.
I'm going to take a little detour right now. And we're talking with Dr. Michael Irving, Toronto, Canada. His website, again, is heartwellness.irvingstudios.com. Heartwellness.irvingstudios.com. Please visit so you can get your free gifts. He has gifts for you, and I'm going to be there right after the show getting mine. We're going to go back to talking about heart health, but I'm going to take a little detour right now to talk about this interesting research that you're just getting in touch with now, preliminary findings about the effects of childhood abuse upon both men and women. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, it was really interesting. You know, when I had my first heart attack, I myself thought, you know, some of the reason that I'm in here with a heart attack is because I've got a broken heart. And a few of my friends used that word. They said, you know, you've got to look at how you've had a broken heart from what happened to you in terms of what's caused your heart disease and what you have to deal with. And I'd been in therapy for decades and thought I was a smart guy. And I had to look at that in this whole issue, and in many ways it makes sense that that child abuse causes a broken heart and that it causes stress. But some very recent research, and I call it preliminary because I don't think that it's large enough studies. I think the preliminary research is showing that there's value to looking more into investigating these areas. And what some of the preliminary research is showing is that women who were sexually abused as a child have a 60% higher incidence of heart attacks, and male survivors have three times the heart attack of their peers. So I think that there are two implications to that. There are two things that we need to look at. One is that in the cardiac rehab programs, we need to look at that population of people going through rehab, there's probably a large percentage of those people, and I don't know what the percentage is yet. I think we need to do some solid research in that area, but definitely a large percentage of the people in cardiac rehab programs are going to be sexual abuse survivors. And if that's not dealt with, and particularly if you've had a heart attack and you have post-traumatic stress, you have a 30% raise in the likelihood of a second heart attack and of a fatal heart attack. So that's pretty significant, because heart disease is reversible and is preventable, 95% of the cases, and even severe heart disease is reversible. But if there's post-traumatic stress and the post-traumatic stress isn't resolved, there's a high likelihood of having another heart attack. So that's the one issue. The other is in treatment of survivors, both males and female survivors of child sexual abuse and of trauma. We need to be looking at that it's not only the issues of trust that have to be dealt with. It's not only the issues of boundaries. It's not only the issues of fog and other kinds of problems that come with being a survivor. There are issues of heart disease, that 60% more likelihood of dying of a heart attack. You know, that with males, it may be even much higher than that. So we need to, in treatment of child sexual abuse survivors that are adults, we need to look at some of the issues in which the trauma is affecting the body, the trauma is affecting the lifestyle choices, the trauma is affecting the level of stress, and the trauma is affecting how in touch are we with our heart and living from the heart and all of the values of heart. And you know, child abuse has been referred to as soul murder, and the heart is the seat of the soul. And in what degree and in what manner is the heart murdered in child abuse and in having a history of child abuse and child sexual abuse? So I think that we're just on the cusp of beginning to look on that and look in those areas in an in-depthful way. And I think that every program that's treating child sexual abuse survivors needs to include a program that considers, are you living heart healthy, and what is your risk of heart disease, and what are you going to do about that? Now, along with heart disease, I think that you're going to find a variety of other diseases that also raise with being a survivor of early childhood trauma. But you look at our population in North America, 30% of the people in North America are going to die of a heart attack. I mean, if you imagine, if you're in a room of people right now and you look around the room, a third of those people are going to die of a heart attack. If you walk in the shopping mall or go to a baseball game, a third of the people there are going to die of a heart attack. And 150 years ago, it was almost non-existent. And somehow we've lost our attachment to living from the heart. And somehow I think our food has become empty. We're not being filled by it. We don't have a warm heart at the end of a McDonald's meal or some of the other junk food that we put in. Our body is our temple, and would you fill your temple with 90% of the food that's in the average grocery store? Well, I don't think so. So we have to reevaluate a whole bunch of things. Thank you for asking about that, because that's one of the areas that I'm looking at exploring and promoting more. I work with survivors of child abuse, and I work with trauma survivors, and I work with heart health individuals, both one-on-one in clinical sessions as well as workshops and talks and online on my internet stuff. And I built the first national monument to child abuse, a massive, massive monument involving survivors of child abuse. And now, after my heart disease and my heart attack and being enlightened in this area of heart, I have a big focus on heart, but I'm still touched and moved by the survivors of child abuse that I've worked with, and my concern about how much they're at risk of a heart attack, and how much at risk everyone we meet as we go through at least one third of the people. I mean, it's, more people will die of a heart attack than all forms of cancer combined. I mean, it's just appalling, and it's an epidemic, and I think the reason we have a hard time really realizing it is because we've lost heart.
We have indeed. And before we go back to what do we mean from heart, I'm going to just interject my story. You know my story.
Oh, please.
That I was, you want to, can we go in there for a minute? Because it might help other people to hear my story. And I'll
yes,
make it
yeah, I would love to. I'd love to.
Okay. So Dr. Irving knows that I went through a rapid series of deaths and traumas and losses in 2011. My mother and my best friend passed away 33 days apart. My boyfriend abandoned me when my mother became fatally ill. My last close relative passed away, and another dear friend passed away all within 6 months. But the thing that really put me over the edge was learning in the middle of all of this, recovering memories, that I had been abused by a beloved relative when I was very young. I had not remembered this. I was age 58 when this happened. And all of a sudden, I'm going through all of this trauma, which was overwhelming to go through this much at one time. And somebody who I just adored, who I believed adored me back, had been my abuser from a very, very young age until probably the age of 6 or 7. And that was that broke my heart, literally. When I learned that, when I recovered those memories, and I remember thinking, my heart is broken. I could have recovered from all the deaths, could have even possibly recovered from the boyfriend leaving me right when I needed him. That was the thing I couldn't deal with. And 13 months after my mother passed away, I have within 2 weeks, I have what's called broken heart syndrome, cardiomyopathy, which is like a heart attack without the lasting damage. And then 2 weeks later, I had a disabling stroke. And I know that the sexual abuse piece was a big part of this. Would you speak to people like me who either don't remember their abuse until they get later in life or never remember their abuse? Does it still affect them?
Yeah. I think there are two parts of that. And it's fascinating as I age and have more experience in life. I think that frequently, even when we know we go through an adversity, there's a significant part of the trauma experience that is unconscious, that we're not conscious of exactly how we got traumatized, or maybe aren't conscious of it at all. And what's fascinating, and I think it's a little bit, you know, working with positive psychology and sort of shifting beyond the 20th century trauma model that we've got a trauma and we have to uncover all of it and see all of it and sort of get rid of our defenses, that very often that the same way that 90% of trauma is unconscious, I think that 90% of the healing is also unconscious, that having good, loving relationships helps to heal our trauma. Looking at the ways that, this is what's really fascinating, looking at the ways we are wounded as we move through life and the ways in which that wounding has in some ways been an outcome of adversities, of traumatic events, that the way in which we are wounded is the place where we are wounded is very often where we are strong. So rather than trying to get rid of our symptomatology, I think that we're really looking at trying to transform it, to heal it. If a soccer player, a world-caliber soccer player, is having a picnic on Sunday with their family and the babies on the table, and a soccer ball comes flying through the picnic area and is heading towards the baby, the foot that the soccer player will get a broken toe on will be their strong foot, not their weak foot, because they will just unconsciously kick out with the foot that is strongest to protect the baby. And we do the same thing. When a trauma comes into our life, it's not our weakness that we face the trauma with, it's our strength. And so very often, the ways in which we are wounded is really the way in which we are also strong. And so we need to embrace our wounds and see the strength in them. If somebody, I can assure you that if somebody has depression because they have lots of negative self-talk, that what they need to do is not stop self-talking and not stop doing lots of self-talk, because if the thoughts that you have can create feelings and those feelings create an attitude, so if you've got negative thoughts that are creating negative feelings and that's creating negative attitudes, well, your strength is that you think a lot and that you give meaning to things, and that you have, not only do you think a lot and give meaning, but you have feelings that are highly intense. And what does that look like? That looks like depression. Well, if you're highly depressed, you have the skills to be obsessively happy, to be obnoxiously happy, because the way that you become happy is to have happy thoughts, is to have positive thoughts, is to have lots of good thoughts that create feelings, and that those feelings create how you are, that what you think is what how you feel, and how you feel is what you create. So if the way that you respond to events is to think a lot, and that ends up getting you depressed, don't stop thinking and don't stop feeling. Change the thoughts. That's your strength. If your strength is humor, you know, the old trauma psychology model was if your humor was your defense, you needed to stop being humorous and be serious and be mature in life. Well, if your humor is your defense, then that's what your strength is. So change the humor. Don't use your humor to distance yourself from people. Use your humor to be closer to people. You know, if your humor is sarcasm, change your humor. Don't stop being humor. Just find humor that makes you feel good rather than sarcastic and bitter. And so I think that some of going through therapy and facing those wounds and looking at them is vital and important. But Cheryl, what I've seen with you is some of your healing has been because you've gone to some really good healers, but some of your therapy is that you have taken your strength and you've applied that to taking care of your dog and taking care of some people around you and making a difference in the lives of others, because of the very way in which you got wounded is the very way in which you're making other people's lives better. And I see that making your own life better. The way that you manage the hurricane there in New Jersey and the way in which people came to you and the way in which you came to other people was just miraculous. And at the same time, it healed you. You know, people were going through post-traumatic stress out of that hurricane, and here's Cheryl becoming a healthier person out of it. Why? Because you were applying your strength that were also the places where you were wounded to transforming. And you didn't consciously do that to fix your trauma, but in the end, that's what it did.
You know, I love how you interpreted that. And I remember going through the hurricane and thinking, I'm having a great time. Now, keep in mind, I didn't want people to have
that's
their
because you were taking care of other people. That's because you were practicing loving kindness.
Well, you know, that's what I do. That's who I am. And I remember at one point going through this and thinking, I don't know if it's right to be this happy. I was just, the thing that made me the happiest was we had a community. All of a sudden, you would go to the grocery store to charge your cell phone. People would walk into the grocery store at 7 o'clock in the morning in slippers and bathrobes. I'm not making this up. Hair curlers. And they had these huge cell phone charging centers. So people started talking to each other. What a concept. They started connecting with each other, person to person. And people started asking, how are you doing? Do you have power back? It was the most loving community I've ever been a part of. And it happened because we had this huge storm.
And so your adversity, every adversity has an equal or greater benefit. And the way that comes about is, on one hand, you believe that you're going to get through it. The other is that you look for the gifts in it. And then you walk through it looking for the flowers to smell. And that's
this is a really good
in your community. Pardon me?
We I never expected our conversation to go to the hurricane, and I'm really glad we're talking about this. I think we're modeling for people what's possible when these awful things happen, like abuse or hurricanes or plagues or whatever it is. We always have a choice. How do we handle it? Do we have to go into this is really awful? We can go there for a while. That's okay. But we don't have to stay there if we don't want to. We can find another way through. And I'm glad we went here in the conversation.
I think when you ask about helping people and how could, you know, my experience and story help people, and I think that you just hit the point, is that it is very important to feel absolutely miserable about something wretched that happens. I mean, you know, these things shouldn't happen. And you're right to feel miserable, and each one of us is going to be feeling miserable in a different way. It may be sadness, or it might be hurt, or it might be angry. But the important thing is that you also move beyond it, that you don't stay locked there, that you move along in time.
That is so true. And for whatever reason, our culture doesn't like us to show feelings. We can't be authentic. Like if somebody dies, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. It's a complete lie, but that's what we're taught to do because people don't want to hear about us. But when you embrace the fact that you're feeling lousy for a while, allow that to happen, and then look for the next step. That's where true healing happens, correct?
Yeah. I think that grief and loss is a very good example because there is, I refer to a difference between pain and suffering. And you know, in some ways, working with pain patients taught me this in a deeper, more poignant way. Because I saw people who were in a lot of pain, and some of them were contented and happy, even though they had pain. And I began to look at some people that went through grief. And there's a difference between the pain of grief. The pain of grief is the hurt and the loss and the sadness. And the suffering of grief, the same way the suffering of physical pain, is regret and dread. When you regret that something happened or you dread that it's going to happen again, that when you're locked in, and we have different words for regret and dread. You know, I wish this didn't happen, or why did this happen, or why did you do that, or whatever it is. And that's the regret. And the dread is, it's always going to be like this, or it's never going to be, or this is going to happen. So when we get rid, when we walk away from regret and dread, we may have pain, but we don't have suffering. And I see that there's three ways to walk away from regret and dread. You change the language from regret and dread to whatever language. Very often all you do is take the words that you're, the self-talk, and turn it 180 degrees from I'll never be happy again to I'm going to be happy again. So you change the words. You get distracted. You look after taking care of something, one else or something else, or you get into the present moment, and that's the mindful journey, that when you're in the present moment, you're not in the past, which is the regret, or you're not in the future, which is the dread. You're in the present moment. Now, you may have physical pain, but the odd thing is that when you leave the suffering, the physical pain is not as significant, and also the physical pain heals quicker. If you stay in suffering, there is a chance that your physical pain will stay for a long time or forever. And if you're trying to get through an illness or trying to get through a loss, the longer you're in the suffering, the longer the loss, the longer the illness will last. And there is something in it, and it's such an exquisite simplicity. Regret and dread, leave the regret and dread. How do you do that? Change the language, get distracted, find a way to be in the present moment.
This is brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. Again, I think you've helped some people greatly. You'll never know who, possibly, but by this conversation, I know that we're changing lives, and I thank you for sharing what you're sharing. Believe it or not, we're almost out of time, and I would like you, if you could briefly cover your 12 wisdoms. Can you do that for us?
I don't have them in front of me, so I'm going to have to. So when I first was in the cardiac rehab program for, in 9 months, my VO2 went from 26 to 38, which was like a 60% improvement. And I got a call from the cardiac supervisor, the head supervisor in the largest cardiac clinic in North America. And she said, you know, we redid your test 3 times this morning and looking for what was wrong. And I'm ready to have a heart attack on the other end of the cell phone. She said, you're the most improved that we have seen in 25 years. And then I really went into this trying to, almost like a shock, trying to make sense of what it was that I did. And I came up with 12 wisdoms to a healthy heart. One is family and friends, connecting with family and friends. And you know, first when you have a heart attack, your doctors, your healthcare team is really important, and your medicines and supplements are really important. We're up to 3. And then the foods you eat and the exercise that you do, and then visualization. You know, fortunately, I had done a lot of training in visualization. When I went through heart surgery, I was visualizing nonstop the whole time about getting better. And then life balance, a spiritual connection, meditation. And we're up to 9. I don't have my little list here. And basically all of those things that we mean by heart, what does heart mean? And if you look at that and you make a list of what heart means, then I think that you'll have a real key idea of what you need to prevent heart disease and to reverse heart disease. And as I say, it is important that you eat the right foods, but as significantly, it's why are you eating them and how are you eating them.
That makes a lot of sense. And can you help people? I've talked about this with one of my previous guests, Dean Schrock, and I said, what do you say to people who tell you, I don't know how to feel? And Dean said that's pretty common with men. So for people who don't know, what do we mean by heart? People who haven't been in touch with their heart for whatever the reason, how can you encourage people to get in touch with their heart, and what do they need to do to live from their heart?
Well, you can look at some of the things that are meant by heart and begin to add those things to your life. I think for many of us, a good place to start is with some kind of a program that teaches mindfulness meditation, because when you're mindful, you're aware, and then you'll start being aware of some of your anxiety and some of your needs. The other thing is we kind of know what heart is. Heart is an aesthetic connection to things. Heart is relationships and close relationships and love. Heart is really a spiritual connection, a sense of belongingness. And I think that is a good place to start. If you're saying, you know, I'm not very in touch with my feelings, then ask yourself, what is heart, and how do you begin to put that in your life? Walking through a park and just noticing the sounds around you, and some of those sounds are the sounds of birds, and some of those sounds of our children or people having a picnic, and some of those are sounds of wind. And I think the more you're mindful and aware of the present moment, the closer you get to being aware of your feelings. If your feelings are really numb and really dead, then it might be very helpful to get with a professional person, a good clinician, a good psychotherapist, who can help you uncover some of what the deadness might be about. And sometimes when you have a complete loss of feelings, sometimes it's a tough journey opening them up. Tough journey, I mean, uncovering them. And then a tough journey in going through some of the painful things that made us kill our emotions. My son just
Dr. Irving, we're out of time. I wish we had more time, but we're out of time right now. And I thank you so much for all that you shared. Your website, again, is heartwellness.irvingstudios.com. My website is transformingthroughlove.com. I'm Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer. Thanking you so much for being here with us tonight. And what do you do when life happens? You know the answer now. You get catalytic. Thanks again, and many blessings.